Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has two matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Fan Song Kim, individually and doing business as P1 Food Store, versus Aldolfo Pena, individually and as representative of the estate of Elizabeth and Melissa Pena, and Randy Earl Lee Ertman and Sandra Lee Ertman, individually and as personal representatives of the estate of Jennifer Lee Ertman from Harris County, and Ford Motor Company, Lee Johnson Ford Incorporated, and Friend Cap DeVille versus Barry Shelton and others from Travis County. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for oral argument. Petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. You may purchase a tape of these arguments from the clerk of our court for a nominal charge. Justice Abbott is not sitting in the first matter. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Fan Song Van versus Pena.
May I please the court? Mr. Dan Sankin, present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Dan Shank and I represent P1 Food Store. P1 seeks reversal of the decision of the Court of Appeals because there was no genuine issue in this case as to either cause and fact or foreseeability of the arising out of the negligence alleged against P1 Food. The questions to be answered by this court today are as follows. Does the superseding criminal act of an off-site capital murder negate the proximate cause element of a negligence claim against a convenience store owner under dram shop liability theories? Number two, is a capital murder an injury of such a general character as to be anticipated when selling beer to individuals either 17 or 18 or allegedly to be intoxicated? Number three, is evidence of a superseding cause involving a criminal act such as capital murder, which involved an elevated mens rea and aggravated intentional conduct, such as to be sentenced to death by lethal injection, sufficient to negate proximate cause? Number four, and relatedly, what is the definitional coverage of superseding cause in connection with a capital murder, such that once it negates proximate cause, is it then the burden of the respondent to a motion for summary judgment to come forward with some evidence of foreseeability? Next, and on a different tack, an issue that was not addressed by the Court of Appeals. Was the alleged negligent conduct in question a substantial factor in bringing about the capital murders in question at a distant location hours after the alleged sale of the beer? Second, can the negligence in question be the cause and fact where there was, and the record's very clear about this, and even the Court of Appeals found this, that there was a chance encounter by the victims with their assailants, and does that, in that circumstance, rebut a but-for analysis? Now, the court has to address an issue here that has some public policy overtones. As the court will recognize, a limits of proximate cause analysis necessarily mandates weighing the public policy considerations of when one party can be responsible for the conduct of another party.
Ms. Shank, does the court have to conclude as a matter of law that the commission of a crime is a superseding cause to get to the point that you say that the plaintiff had the burden shifted to the plaintiff on summary judgment to bring forth evidence that raises a fact issue on it?
Your Honor, I don't believe it has to, although it is certainly a basis upon which to make this decision.
The plaintiff argues that the posture of this case is essentially you're saying that's what we must do because all you introduced a summary judgment was that there was a crime that occurred.
Well, I think that's belied by the record. When you look, even the Court of Appeals found that there was a chance encounter that occurred at a distant location, that it was not on the premises of P1 Food Store. I mean, there was substantial evidence to show.
But the only proof that you offered in support of your summary judgment motion were the indictments and the conviction.
That's not correct. And there's also evidence of the criminal transcript.
Pardon me?
The criminal transcript is also in the record.
Okay. From the trial
yes.
of the... Okay,
yes.
But everything that was associated with the criminal proceeding?
Yes.
You didn't put on any proof of anything else?
No, we did not.
And the Court of Appeals decision, in fact, turned on a question of summary judgment procedure under the old rules before the no evidence rule.
But let me go back.
Correct? Didn't the decision turn on that?
Yes, and I think the
statement And they decided that you did not meet your burden under the old summary judgment rule to establish the absence of proximate cause as a matter of law.
Now, what they found was that we didn't meet our burden to negate foreseeability, which is an element of proximate cause. And if I could answer Judge Enoch's question first, if you go back to the Lear-Sigler and the Doe cases and Al Britton versus Union Pump, you still have to show that the act in question was a substantial factor in bringing about the negligence.
But the plaintiff or the respondent to a summary judgment motion under the old procedure, before the no evidence procedure was adopted, had no burden whatsoever under a summary judgment until you met your burden to negate the element as a matter of law.
I agree, but I also think the definitional coverage of superseding cause, if the court will go back and look at the definition of superseding cause in the restatement towards section 440, and what that says is, you get the quote, superseding cause is an act of a third person or other force which by its intervention prevents the actor from being liable for harm to another, which is antecedent negligence, for which is antecedent negligence is a substantial factor in bringing about. So what it assumes is cause in fact and proximate cause. And what it says is, it's in the nature of an affirmative defense, which we demonstrated as a matter of law, that there was no genuine issue of material fact but that a capital murder had occurred. And all we're saying is that in this context, that they then had to come back and offer some evidence of foreseeability in order to go to trial and not have the case dismissed on summary judgment.
Didn't you have to negate foreseeability as a matter of law before the burden shifted to the plaintiff to raise a fact issue on that element?
Yes, and by proving a superseding cause by definition as defined in section 440 of the restatement of torts, I believe we did that, Your Honor.
Would your answer be different if the crime had been, say a DWI, where intervening criminal activity was foreseeable?
Yes.
The sale of alcoholic beverages.
Yes, and I think you need to draw a distinction between the zone of danger which arises out of the alleged negligence. In this context, and I think the court will go back and look at the Fifth Circuit's decision in the Skipper case, they drew that very distinction where it dealt with, and the Skipper case dealt with a premeditated murder that occurred on site, and it was alleged that the individual sold beer or alcohol, whatever, repeatedly after he was already intoxicated. And the Fifth Circuit held as a matter of law that the premeditated murder was a superseding cause and distinguished that case from an involuntary manslaughter case where an individual, it is foreseeable in our society that those of us who go drink alcoholic beverages or might go to a convenience store to buy them, that you're going to drive to that facility and then drive somewhere else. That is within the zone of danger for which the Dram Shop Act was enacted. A premeditated murder is not within that context.
But
I would draw that distinction.
But you mentioned that the Fifth Circuit found that premeditated murder was, as a matter of law, superseding cause.
Yes.
In this case, you're not arguing that. What you're arguing is that the record from the capital murder trial provides evidence on all of the elements of a superseding cause as defined in the restatement.
Actually, I'm arguing both. And to be frank, I mean, what I'm arguing is that we proved the superseding cause as a matter of law arising out of the capital murders, and that then they had to come back with some evidence of foreseeability. I also would argue to the court that the decision that there was no cause in fact based upon the decisions this court has rendered in the Lear-Sigler, Union Pump, and Doe cases.
What did the indictment indicate in the criminal matters were the aggravating circumstances that made the charge capital murder?
Robbery and rape. Furthermore, and I ask the court to go back if you're interested in looking at the indictment, the actual convictions, it was a finding that these individuals posed a hazard to society, which is necessary in order to sentence someone to death by lethal injection.
What kind of evidence could the respondents in this case have offered to raise a material fact issue?
Let me go back and discuss the evidence, and I think that was because the question sort of drew me off tack here. The facts in this case were, and let me say that they did not offer any evidence of foreseeability. There was no evidence with reference to P1 Food Store at all in the record. The only evidence in the record was that Jennifer Urban and Elizabeth Pena were raped, robbed, and murdered by six assailants, aged 17 to 18, and one 14-year-old at a railroad trestle located across White Oak Bayou in Houston, Texas, on June 24, 1993, at 11:30 p.m. But they encountered these young men by chance. That five of these assailants were sentenced to death by lethal injection, but the 14-year-old was sentenced to 40 years in prison. It's alleged that P1 Food Store sold beer to the minors or to the individuals when they were either minors or intoxicated. The only evidence of any sale in the record was that Joe Cantu purchased three or four bottles of beer, presumably quarts of beer, at some unspecified convenience store located near LLE and Loop 610. But they went to someone's apartment for some time. There was testimony in the record that Joe Cantu had been drinking before he bought the beer, and afterwards there was testimony that on the railroad tracks they got all hyper and drunk. But there was no evidence here that P1 knew the assailants or the propensity to commit criminal acts or whether they were alcoholics, drug addicts, gang members, whatever. There was no evidence of any prior criminal occurrences at P1's location or involving the sale of liquor or beer.
Did you offer affirmative proof on all these things?
No, we did
you're
not.
Saying there's no evidence?
No, we relied upon prior decisions by the 14th Court of Appeals.
Well, but the point is that when you say there's no evidence, what you're saying is the plaintiff didn't offer any, but you in the first instance did not move for summary judgment on the grounds that, for example, your client did not sell the liquor at the first
place. No, we did not. That was not the basis for the our motion. There was no expert testimony in the record. There was no and there was no evidence of any prior sales to minors or intoxicated persons by P1 Food Stores. There was no evidence of supervision of the premises at which the activity occurred, and there was no evidence of any control of the third parties in question. And I think if the court goes back and looks at all the decisions in this area, it either involves something that occurs on someone's premises, or someone has a special relationship with the individual who commits the third party who commits the act. There's no case that can be found that goes as far as this decision goes as it relates to proximate cause. One other point I would like to make to the court, and this court has rendered a recent decision, the Walker versus Harris case, and has also made a recent decision in the Timberwalk case, where, and there's been some comment in the literature, and I would ask the court to go back and look at the Court of Appeals decision for San Antonio in the Kendrick case. They all discuss how crime is pervasive in our society, and the natural result of that is that tort claims are being made against third parties relating to those criminal acts. And there's a discussion in the Kendrick case, and I think if you go back and look at the Walker and Timberwalk case, that given the pervasive nature of the crime crime in our society, that you end up having to have a little more restrictive view of foreseeability than has traditionally been applied in tort cases. And I think that's an important issue for this court to address, and with that, I'll sit down and let the counsel respond.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Matthew Prebeg will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court, Justices, I'm Matthew Prebeg and I represent the respondents. The First Court of Appeals did correctly decide this case. They correctly reversed the trial court's summary judgment, and I ask you to affirm their decision. The first court's decision was correctly decided because the petitioner did not carry a summary judgment burden that existed at the time it was rendered.
What was in your live pleading at the time of summary judgment? What specific facts did you allege gave rise to first jurisdiction?
We specifically alleged that the convenience store sold alcohol to children between the ages of 14 and 18. And or visibly intoxicated at the time of the sale.
Any other fact that you allege that you say made it foreseeable to the convenience store owner that these people would go out and commit the crimes that they did?
I don't remember, but I'll look. I don't remember exactly what percentage of conviction, but I do know that you did allege.
Are there any facts in the record that beyond the fact of the act of the crime itself that you say would have given the convenience store owner some notion that this might have happened, this crime might have happened?
We did state foreseeability. We stated that they were teenage gang members, and that in and of itself, and the thrust of respondent's argument is that it is common knowledge among almost all people that if you sell alcohol, or you give alcohol, especially a professional seller of alcohol, to children between the ages of 14 and 18, we're talking about under the age of 18, that it, irrational behavior is going to result, assaultive conduct, aggressive conduct will result. That is something that is reasonably foreseeable for every adult. And that's what we allege. We allege that the sale occurred to visibly intoxicated teenagers and the foreseeable result was assaultive conduct.
And that is Mr. Shank's argument, of course, would be that in order to get them convicted of capital murder, they had to have enough faculty left in their brains to make a choice that this is what they were going to do. And it seems to me that's inconsistent with the liability of the proprietor who gives them alcohol to the point that they are no longer capable of making their own decisions on what to do. So it seems to me those two concepts don't fit very well. It's one thing to impair one's ability to drive a car and therefore they're negligent and have an accident. It's another thing to say that I intentionally run someone over with the car and that should have been foreseeable by someone who was giving them alcohol that would impair their ability to function. If capital murder seems to me it's an intentional conduct. It seems to be inconsistent with the notion that the proprietor impaired their conduct to where the proprietor's liable for their actions.
I believe that it is common knowledge that when people get drunk, they will intentionally often hurt somebody. That's why there are signs in bars that say it is illegal to carry a weapon on these premises. At least I've been told by friends that there are signs in bars that say that. It's common knowledge that the sale of alcohol to anybody is going to increase the level of irrational behavior. It's going to provide
it's hard to get to a capital murder as opposed to simply the general intent to shoot a firearm. To get to capital murder requires something else.
And that's the reason that this case is a difficult case on its facts, but it's important on the law and what this court is going to hold today. One of the primary arguments that I interpret from petitioner's brief is that this conduct was so bad that because it was so bad, it was non-foreseeable. In other words, if it had merely been a fist fight, if someone had got, if a child had gotten drunk and just got in a fist fight or slugged someone, that might be foreseeable, but a capital murder is not. However, Texas law is clear, and it has set out in the Nixon case that the actor does not have to anticipate the particular crime that occurred. It just has to anticipate the general character of the harm.
Well, in this case, store owners, if they sell liquor to an adult, for example, who is visibly intoxicated, and that adult goes home and beats his wife or beats his children, are convenience store owners going to be liable for those types of situations?
That would be for another case, Your Honor. I don't know what this court would hold in that regard, but that is not before the court.
What's the difference? I mean,
yes. We
an adult who's obviously intoxicated, let's say he's cursing, he's in a foul humor, and the convenience store owner sells them liquor. Are convenience stores going to be liable under those circumstances for any crimes that the intoxicated person might do?
If the court affirms this case, the answer is no. The reason is, as in the Chapman case, the court in that case recognized that the sale of guns is arguably a good thing. It is legal in the state of Texas to sell alcohol to people over the age of 21. It is illegal to sell them under the age of 21. However, this case is even out of the drain trap because it's the sale of alcohol to people so young. It is inexcusable and it cannot be a mistake to sell the alcohol to children 14 years of age.
What could or should have Van Son Van said in a summary judgment motion to negate foreseeability?
Van Son Van would have had to have said and brought evidence that I, a professional seller of alcohol, could not have foreseen that if I gave alcohol to these teenage gang members between the ages of 14 and 18 that I could not have foreseen that they might have gone out and hurt
That's
somebody.
That's a conclusory statement. What facts would be appropriate for the summary judgment evidence?
I don't know, and I honestly cannot imagine an adult liquor license holder making a statement like that or offering any kind of proof that it could not have foreseen that assaultive conduct would not result or irrational behavior would not result in the sale of alcohol to children. I cannot imagine what kind of evidence they could have brought to prove that. Now, they could have brought evidence that said this would have happened anyway. They could have brought evidence that said it doesn't matter, the sale does not matter, it did not play a substantial factor here because, for instance, these teenage gang members premeditated this murder. They targeted these girls, but that didn't happen. It was not a premeditated murder, and that exactly underscores our argument. We brought evidence, summary judgment evidence, that negated superseding cause. We brought evidence from eyewitnesses at the scene that said we left because we knew something bad was going to happen. They were getting all hyper and drunk. They were getting out of control because they were drunk. The very fact that they were drunk caused these people who may have already been bad children and gang members to get all hyper and drunk. That's been a substantial factor. Therefore, they eliminated, a crucial factor in superseding cause was eliminated, that is independence.
Let me ask you a quick question.
Yes, ma'am.
In a summary judgment movement can do one of two things to be entitled to summary judgment. They can either negate an element of the plaintiff's cause of action, which in this case would be foreseeability, or they can establish all elements of an affirmative defense, right?
Yes.
If they establish all elements of superseding cause, which is in the nature of an affirmative defense, why then shouldn't we shift the burden back to the plaintiff to come forward with evidence? Because I think we're talking just about burden shifting here.
Yes.
Why shouldn't we treat superseding cause like we would any other affirmative defense and shift the burden accordingly?
For two reasons. First, they did not prove a superseding cause.
But let's assume they did for purposes of argument. What if they did prove it? Then would you agree the burden should shift back to the plaintiff to show that it was nevertheless foreseeable?
Yes, if I could answer that in two steps. First, if they did prove a superseding cause initially with their summary judgment evidence, then the record is clear that the respondents did provide evidence that it was not a superseding cause. But assuming that the evidence provided by the respondents was not enough to negate an element of superseding cause,
right.
In that case, the answer is still no. Exactly as to the extent that they did not prove non-foreseeability with the DWI case.
It's a very limited question, though. I mean, if you agree that they have proved superseding cause, you would also agree that in that event, now I realize you can test whether they proved it or not, but if in fact they did prove superseding cause, you would agree we should treat it like an affirmative defense and the burden would then shift back to the plaintiff as in any other affirmative defense?
If superseding cause, by definition, includes means that non-foreseeability has been established, then I would concede.
Okay, thank you.
The petitioner's argument in their brief, I interpret it to mean that they want this court to interpret the Chapman v. Osmond's case and confirm an interpretation that would hold that there is a superseding cause that is established any time a crime is committed. Immediately under all circumstances. That is not what the Chapman Court held. And if it did, then it was wrongly decided. The Chapman Court struggled with the public policy issues in that case. The Chapman Court considered summary judgment evidence, and it strictly limited its holding to that case. In fact, the Chapman Court stated that there are certainly many factual situations which make criminal conduct a foreseeable result of the sale of a gun. And it said, in this instance, and the facts of this case, there was a superseding cause that required proof by the respondent.
If we accept the petitioner's position that they did negate foreseeability as a matter of law, what proof is in the record to raise a fact issue to controvert that proof?
In this instance, no, there is no evidence, and none is needed, because we don't need to bring evidence the sun will rise tomorrow. We don't need to bring evidence of things that are within the common knowledge of all adults, and that is that if you sell alcohol to teenage gang members, something bad is going to happen. An assault will probably occur.
If we were to agree with you and affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals and it went back to the trial court and the defendant moved on the grounds of no evidence of proximate cause, then what proof would you be required and would you put on in order to raise a fact issue to keep the case alive?
Then the burden clearly is going to shift to us. I would immediately call on somebody from the Texas Alcohol and Beverage Commission to report the many studies that show the connection between the sale of alcohol to anybody and increased aggression and irrational behavior. And then I would concentrate on the children themselves, selling alcohol to children. Then I would depose the person that sold the alcohol and see if they are willing to state under oath that they could not have foreseen irrational and assaultive conduct resulting from selling alcohol to a 14-year-old teenage gang member. And I would offer that to the court.
So you would agree, though, that if it does go, if it were to go back and the defendant moved on no evidence grounds, you would have a burden to come forward with actual proof to raise a fact issue on foreseeability?
Under the current summary judgment rule, yes.
A question. You keep referring to the 14-year-old as the purchaser. Is that allegations by your petition, or is there any proof in the record that the 14-year-old was the one who purchased from the petitioner?
I can't exactly remember the words we used in the petition, but I think we stated the ages of the children, and we did state that the children, that the store sold the alcohol to the children, and they were teenage gang members at the time of the sale, and they were intoxicated at the time of the sale. That was those were our allegations. There was no proof offered to controversial
facts. As to effect. Which one was the person who purchased the alcohol at this particular store?
Yes.
There's no proof of that. Although the petitioner used the name of Mr. Cantu. What age was Mr. Cantu?
I think Mr. Cantu was the oldest. He was 18. I've forgotten the names of the 14-year-old, but as I understand it, and this is not in the record, so it's not going to be helpful.
Well, is it factually correct in the sense that if they sold the alcohol to Mr. Cantu, that they also sold it to the 14-year-old? Or that he bought it and then passed it on, Mr. Cantu?
My understanding of what occurred is that at least two, probably three, entered the store and bought the alcohol. And I believe Mr. Cantu was one of the persons who entered.
Is it fair to say it's also common knowledge that usually they send in the most oldest-looking person to buy as opposed to the youngest person for obvious reasons?
They probably do, Your Honor. They probably do. Your Honor, I do want to point out that there was no evidence offered by petitioner in the summary judgment motion to negate our allegation.
Well, but
there were children under the age.
I know, but your allegations to the petition don't count for purposes of summary judgment. Would you agree with that?
No, Your Honor, I would not.
You just think you can go in on your allegations in your petition without any summary judgment proof on your side?
I
understand that your position is that you don't think they carried their burden. But assume they did, don't you have to have summary judgment evidence to support your allegations? You can't just rely on them?
I believe I can rely on the facts alleging the petition until they're controverted by the moving summary judgment evidence. At that point, it would be my burden to prove that, and I could have done that rather easily. But they did not raise that issue, therefore no evidence was brought. And these are the rules that existed at the time. I understand the rules are different now, but at the time this hearing took place, the summary judgment, actually not a hearing, it was a submission, it was well before the rule change. And so,
well, I don't think there's any dispute by either party that we're under 166AC and not I, and that they have the burden to prove no foreseeability as a matter of law. But as the question from the other end of the bench was, if they prove that, weren't you required to come forward with summary judgment evidence to raise fact questions, even under Part C?
If they did prove non-foreseeability, that is correct.
So basically here, then,
the court's inquiry is, did they carry their burden and show foreseeability? No foreseeability is a matter of law. Otherwise,
yes,
you have nothing in the record that would raise a fact question. Is that true?
Except for pleading, which were not controverted. Yes.
Okay.
Because no superseding cause was established at the trial court level, and because the respondents provided evidence that defeated any allegation of superseding cause, the assaultive and irrational conduct that did occur was a result of the sale of this alcohol to these teenagers. That is within the realm of common knowledge for most people. And that is why the First Court of Appeals correctly decided the case. And they did correctly understand that this was a difficult case because of the severity of the harm. Nevertheless, they understood that the severity of the harm need not have been anticipated. Only the general character, that is assaultive conduct, was correctly decided. And for those reasons, the respondents asked this court to affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
Just a couple of brief points, not to belabor the argument. I think Justice O'Neill hit the nail on the head with what our position is. And I think if you go back and look at the response to the petition for review that we filed, one of the original arguments made by the respondents was that superseding cause was an affirmative defense that we had failed to plead. We responded under various case law that showed that it was in our motion for summary judgment, and therefore, and that they had not objected to the failure to plead it, so therefore they had waived that issue. They had since dropped that argument, but in their response, they did state that superseding cause was an affirmative defense. So therefore, if we go back to the Moorburger analysis, where we proved a superseding, an affirmative defense, and then the burden would shift to them to show the exception to that affirmative defense. Because if the court would go back and look at the definition, and look at the restatement of tort section 448, it says intentional criminal conduct is ordinarily a superseding cause unless it is foreseeable as a result of it is a foreseeable substantial likelihood as a result of the negligent conduct in question. So the point I'm trying to make is that when the restatement used the term unless, it meant that there was an exception. And once we proved the rule, under a Moorburger summary judgment type analysis, then the burden shifted to the...
Why isn't it your burden to not only prove that, to also prove the exception does not apply?
Isn't that the
old summary judgment practice?
No, I think under the old summary judgment practice, if you prove the rule, that it's up to the defendant to come forward with an exception, or the respondent to come up with evidence of
but
an exception, to raise a fact issue of the exception.
But the rule includes the exception under the restatement. That's part of the rule.
Yes, it is.
But let me ask you, go back to a question about your argument earlier and follow up on a question that Judge Gonzalez asked. Is it your position that in a case like this, where third-party criminal conduct is at issue, that proof by the defendant of the third-party criminal conduct always negates proximate cause as a matter of law?
No.
Okay. What should the rule be then with respect to that, and under what circumstances are you saying that that should be sufficient as a matter of law?
Intentional criminal conduct like capital murder should create that circumstance. Involuntary manslaughter, or where the criminal statutes do not involve an elevated level of mens rea, do not require that sort of finding. It has to do with...
That's where you draw the line.
That's where I draw the line.
Okay.
And because I think that's an important distinction for this court. Because it also ties back into the jury shop liability theories that should remain available to a plaintiff arising out of those sort of claims where it's within the zone of danger in question. I'd also ask the court to go back and look at the Donnell case, which is another case from, I believe it's from the First Court of Appeals.
So if it involves some sort of a mens rea that included a recklessness standard, then it wouldn't fall over into the matter of law category like you're talking about.
I'm not a criminal law expert, and I don't know if I can draw that distinction on standing here on my feet, but I think that is about where the line should be drawn.
Well,
which side of the line, I don't know.
Do you agree there are circumstances where a defendant could put on proof of third-party criminal conduct and it would not be sufficient to negate proximate cause as a matter of law?
Yes, because, well, particularly if it's a premises liability case. I mean, the court has had to address that in Timberwalk. It's had to address it in the Mellon Bank case, which the court just heard. I mean, those circumstances are clearly distinguishable because it was on premises or in a circumstance where you have a doctor.
Well, but you can still have intentional criminal conduct on premises.
Yes, but you control the premises. It's an entirely different situation.
Isn't that distinction contemplated in the restatement itself? In Section 442, it defines the considerations that are important in determining superseding cause. And the first one says, the fact that its intervention brings about harm different in kind from that which would otherwise have resulted in the actor's negligence. And that would seem to contemplate in the definition itself the premises liability and drunk driving cases.
Absolutely. And I think we went through in our brief an analysis of how Section 442 would apply in this circumstance and be distinguishable from those other circumstances. Just to get back, another point that I wanted to make was that the burden that the plaintiff would put on the defendant really ties into the Truong case filed by out of the Houston Court of Appeals, where we would not have a readily controvertible affidavit that we would have to file to meet the burden that he would suggest. And I don't think the defendant should have to. What you're doing in this, their argument is you could never negate the foreseeability in this context.
Question. Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you, Honor.
That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief.
All right.